Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. Since the cancellation of the 2020 festival, we've been working hard to ensure that this year's program has a new story. Over the coming months, we'll be reimagining a significant number of sessions that were scheduled to take place on our festival stages as podcasts, bringing the writing, ideas, and debates from the 2020 program to online audiences around Australia and the world.
Warami. This is Professor Jacqueline Troy, the Director for Indigenous Research at the University of Sydney. I am a Ngarrindjeri person from the snowy mountains of southeastern Australia, and it's my great pleasure to be talking today with Cassandra Pybus, author of 12 books, a distinguished historian who is now working on a project to continue the revisioning, re-understanding of Aboriginal history in Australia. This is a theme that runs through her work, and her latest book, Truganini, is an amazing contribution to this new consideration, particularly of Aboriginal women. I'm actually situated today in the age of Rona on Ngunnawal country in Canberra, and it's my great pleasure to be in the country of my near neighbours, as I'm Ngarrindjeri from the snowies next door, as I just said. And Cassandra comes to us from the Palawa country in Tasmania, the land of the Tasmanian Aboriginal peoples, who were many groups, but now go under the one banner of being Palawa. Normally, the Sydney Writers' Festival is situated on the land of the Gadigal mob in Sydney. And that's where my university, the University of Sydney, has its main campus. So it's in some ways a multi-Indigenous event today, and we are channeling the elders past and present from the three countries, Gadigal, Palawa and Ngunnawal. Hello, Cassandra.
Hi, Jackie. That was a terrific intro.
I should say Warami again. Hello. So I absolutely loved this book, let me just say. And I love the fact that Truganini leaps out of the pages into my presence in a way that she doesn't leap out of the pages of the historical record, and she doesn't leap out of the pages of other books and other pieces written about her. In fact, she is objectified in a way that I find very distressing as an Aboriginal woman, knowing that this was a very strong woman who fought for the rights of her people, but she disappears into this kind of tragic, gothic, Victorian space where she was bones and flesh and hair that is more of a museum piece. She, the personality that is Truganini, the strong woman who stood up for her people's rights, for her culture, for her languages, disappears. And you've drawn all these threads together in the historical record and given her life and flesh and voice.
Well, that was what I was really trying very hard to do, because, of course, she's only available to us through the kind of self-regarding gaze of white men, one particular white man with whom she spent a lot of time. But basically, that's what we've got to work with. And so the task I set myself was to somehow rescue her from this particularly paternalistic and self-regarding gaze, and try and turn the camera around, as it were, and get her rather than him. Him, in this case, being George Augustus Robinson, who wrote these very detailed diaries, which luckily involved a lot of commentary about her. And so she is available to us a little bit. And so it was, you know, it's a temptation, of course, to then want to invent, to go over into fictionalizing, And I didn't believe for a moment that that was my place to do. And also I'm a historian. And so I've always felt that you can and indeed my whole career has been built on rescuing the people who've been left out of history or forgotten by history. Now, she hasn't been forgotten because she's been turned into this symbol, as you quite rightly point out. The museum piece, the symbol of extinction, the symbol of the lost Stone Age people of Tasmania. I mean, this. I remember seeing the museum piece, the museum. Not, I didn't ever see the skeleton, but I saw the museum display, which made it perfectly clear that these were people like the Neanderthal people who had weren't able to adjust and just disappeared somehow, and that she was the last of them. And that this narrative about lasting and also about being the kind of passive victim of some inexorable process that over which she had no control and was just going to happen because that was the way the world progresses. Now, this is a story that people will still tell themselves about what happened here in Tasmania, and it is my job to make them realise that that's not what happened, that the people here fought, sometimes actively fought, and in otherwise, like in her case, fought in a process of constant negotiation with the colonial authorities to be able to live the way they had always lived. And so what I'm trying to do here is place her in her landscape. A lot of people comment on that. I spent a lot of time going to all the places that I knew she went to and getting a sense of what the... Luckily, it's Tasmania, it hasn't changed much, and a sense of how she belonged in that landscape and how she lived in that landscape and how she was not in any way co-opted by the colonial state that was attempting to destroy her and her people. And that they did not succeed in destroying her because she lived to a good ripe old age. And she lived longer than a lot of women would live in the mid-19th century. So I think that she's at every level, she is a success story and a terribly significant figure in Australian history. And so my task is to make her real and not just this kind of terrible image of... the poor passive victim who, the black body on whom all these terrible things were done. I mean, the dominant narrative about her, you just Google it and you'll get it, is about how she was raped, how she was, you know, members of her family were murdered, how, you know, there's no other story told about her, no positive story told about her. It's as if we really want to talk about the horrors that were inflicted upon her. And that didn't come as a surprise to me because I spent so much time working in the area of North American slave experience and the way in which that was kind of talked about and still is, I'm horrified to say, in the United States, that there is this extraordinary, almost voyeuristic, pornographic interest in violence against the black body. The best example of exposing that, of course, is the movie Get Out. But you see the same thing here, you know, and I say to the Dictionary of Biography that keeps repeating this stuff, why are you so interested in this narrative of violence and victimhood?
Her choice and her capacity to make choices comes through so strongly in this book. That's what I particularly enjoy, the narrative about Aboriginal women even now, and it's reinforced with the stories of domestic and community violence, tends to still be that we are agentless, that we are to be protected and somehow removed from dangerous situations. And you were talking about living near Oyster Cove and how walking through that place inspired you because you could feel the sense of place. Can you tell me about your own connectedness with it? Because this story definitely comes through as one of a real person who really had lots of opinions about the time she was living in, and also about, you know, her experience of going into other people's country when she went up into Kulin country in southeastern so-called mainland Australia. You know, there's a moment of violence there where she's part of the party that perpetrate this, or, I mean, who's the perpetrator in that situation? It's
I think it's pretty clear that they're the perpetrators.
Yes,
and they
but what's caused it is so interesting.
Absolutely.
So here's a woman who, you know, bites back.
Well, she does in various ways. She's very tactical and. As far as I can see, everything is transactional with her. She's first encountered by George Augustus Robinson in a camp for convict woodcutters, and he takes it upon himself to take her across the water from Bruny Island, which is her country, to take her back to her country because he wants to set up a mission station there, and he needs the support of her father, who is the senior man of the Nui Noni. And he thinks that he's rescuing her from these brutal white men, and so he provides her with clothing, which she immediately discards, and with food, which she's, you know, not all that interested in, and heaves off to go to another group of white men at the whaling station. And time and time again, he tries to get her back from the whaling station, and she will run away and hide from him because actually she has a much more direct negotiating relationship with these white men who will also supply with clothes should she want them, and certainly with tea and sugar and flour and the things that she does want, and that this is a well-established relationship. And it's not just her, it's most of the women have this kind of relationship, and that he doesn't understand it at all because he thinks, how could she not prefer me giving her sermons about God and dressing her in kind of clothes that are made from blankets to cover up her nakedness and going off with the scum of the earth, you know. And that this is an issue that he has all the time with her, that he only has her goodwill and her assistance when it is in her to her benefit. And once it ceases to be to her benefit, she doesn't have anything more to do with him. So that when she gets into the land of the Kulin, she basically leaves him, and that's all there is to it, because he is no advantage to her there. This is not, you know, she's better off by herself, really, or making alliances with the Kulin men initially, and then with some of her other Tasmanian colleagues that she goes off into Kulin country with. Now, this is exactly the whole narrative here that I was able to see in his journals. He couldn't see it, but I could see it quite easily, that that's what was going on. And so the narrative that he liked to tell and that is constantly told about him and her, which is how she saves his life when he's attacked by the Takana people at the Arthur River. If you look at his own account of what happens there, it's obvious that she makes this kind of split decision. She's running away. She doesn't want him to follow her. She tells him, you stay away from me because I'm the person that they want. They're going to spear all the other men. They're going to spear you. Leave me alone. And he won't leave her alone. He says, you have to help me. You have to help me. And she makes this split second decision. You can see it happening. She'll either swim. He can't swim. She has to push him across the river. She'll either do that or leave him there to be speared, and that she will probably be caught by these Takana men. And so her choice is, if she goes back into the camp without him, she, you know, what's going to happen to her? If she goes back into his camp with him, having saved him, then, you know, her future is assured. Whereas if she stays with these wild black fellows, as one of the members of the group with her refers to them, it's only a matter of time before Robinson or someone else is going to come for them. And so this is the decision that she makes. And she saves him on a couple of occasions, always making the same kind of judgment, you can see, that she's better off with him than she is, you know, trying to... Because she can see better than almost anybody, except perhaps her husband already, that... who also cleaves very closely to Robinson for the same reason, that only when they're with him are they able to live in their country and practice their spiritual beliefs and hunt and live as close as they can to their traditional life. Now, when he's talking about it, he likes to think that they're somehow listening to his talk about God and the devil and all the rest of it, and that he's in some kind of process of making them like him. But actually they think, I believe, that they're in the process of co-opting him into their culture. And they're very successful at it as long as they're in the bush. Mm. But when there's nobody left in the bush and he sends them off to Flinders Island, that relationship breaks down almost completely because he has betrayed them. And he has nothing more to offer them. But now, by then, they are, of course, imprisoned on an island. And so to save them, he takes them to Victoria, to Kulin country. But they're completely alien there. And so there's no way he can intercede for them or to allow them to live the way they want to live because he has no power in that relationship anymore.
And they have no connection to country.
And they have no connection to country. I think it's very interesting that the last place they go to, which is where this murder takes place, is at the very end of Western Port Bay, which is the closest point to Tasmania. Now, I don't know that they understood that, but they certainly understood that this was country that belonged to no one, that there was nobody there. It wasn't Bunwarran country and it wasn't anybody else's country. The original Bunwarran owners of the land had been extinguished and that it was empty country. And so there was the one place they might have been able to, and they did for months, live out there on their own terms.
I love the description that you have of, you know, they're in this place that's like the land of plenty. And a recognisable place as seafaring, you know, people who are...
Absolutely.
You know, these are people who could make canoes and go out and hunt seal and knew very well how to live off the fruits of the ocean, as you put it. And so...
It was real cornucopia down there, and they were on nobody else's country. They didn't have to fight with anybody else except for the one white settler down there.
Which they dispatched.
By mistake.
More or less.
They dispatched the wrong person. But their quarrel with him was very specific. They thought that he'd murdered their friend.
Yes, that's right.
Were mistaken about that, but nevertheless, that's a perfectly... understandable reason for why they would have tried to kill him.
And these strong women, you know, there's Trukanini taking Watson's wife and going across the river, you know, getting rid of
swimming
them.
Swimming her across the river.
Yeah, like shunting them along and then
saying, okay, it's just right. Run off to the nearest settler, which is over there, while
we kind of burn
your hut down.
Yeah, exactly.
But it is very interesting that when they put all of them, the three women and the two men, Trukanini, two other women and her husband, Mulbohina, and Tunaminaway, are put on trial, Robinson pleads for the women by saying they are in complete thrall to the men. They just do what the men tell them to do. I mean, it's hilarious because, you know, I've been reading through Robinson's journals over and over again. You know, for years he's been talking about how intractable she is, how difficult she is, and how she does what she wants to do. And suddenly, and that is no less true of the other women either, and there he is claiming. And, of course, the court really doesn't want to hang these Aboriginal women, so they just say, you know, they're just They're just
agentless,
passive victims of this case of the Aboriginal men. And that's the point that he's making. Aboriginal men turn women into their women into these kind of passive victims. And that's and that of course is a narrative that people are very happy to hear and to constantly repeat. So the only way that she's given agency in this narrative and in the narrative of her life in Tasmania is as Robinson's woman, you know, as Robinson's sexual kind of toy.
And a future museum piece.
And then as an old woman, she's kind of being eyed up as, you know, a future museum piece. And so you might notice at the end of my book, in the end of the photograph section, this is a photograph of John Woodcock Graves standing over her with his arms folded, looking down on her. Now, if you read her obituaries and thing and newspaper stories about her when she died, John Woodcock Graves features in them quite a bit as her friend and the person who kind of wanted a memorial for her and who wanted to, you know, a song to be written, who named her children, who named his children Mathina and Truganini. He also was one of the people who mutilated the body of her last husband, William Lennie. He was the man who walked out of the Hobart Hospital with Lennie's hands in his pockets. And he's eyeing her up. I mean, he's measuring her with his eyes. He belongs to, he's a prominent member of the Royal Society who instantly put in a claim for her body the moment she died. And so there is her friend. And it's and several other members of the Royal Society also went to visit her when she was an old lady. And they would write, talk about her as if she was some coquettish teenager. You know, and how she always enjoyed her glass of wine. You know, that was the deal, right? You want to come and talk to me, you've got to bring me wine. And it's really amazing the way they kind of talk about her as if she's still this sexualized black object, you know, that they just can't wait to get their hands on. I find it really, really, really offensive and distressing because right up until the end, she was very much in control of, as the woman who was looking after her, Mrs. Dandridge, makes very clear in the testimony that she gives much later on about Truganini, that she was very much that Mrs. Dandridge was very much the person who was her facilitator, you know, that she did what Truganini wanted her to do, basically. And she gives this lovely image of Truganini in her last days sleeping on the floor of the bedroom in the house in Hobart with her dogs, you notice, three or four dogs around her. And she never slept in a bed. She always slept on the floor. Sometimes she'd let the dog sleep on the bed. And that the last thing she heard from Truganini was, "Rajawara, catch me," right? Like not, "God, here I come," or, you know, "My Father who art in heaven." It was like, "At last, you know, at last, I'm going to join my father. I'm going to join my people. Rajawara, catch me. I'm going." Now, this is a woman who has spent all this time since she was 16 years old in the colonial grasp, and she hasn't lost anything of her sense of who she is or what's important to her. She still sleeps on the floor with her dogs.
It defies the notion that Aboriginal people are colonised. That's another thing I love about the book is that, and what you were just saying about she never stopped being Noongar. She always was of her own people. I like the choice of images that you've got in that book. They show this woman who was proud to be dressed wearing dressed in the things that mattered to her, her beautiful marina shell necklace. She always has that same look of self-assertion, even in that image, as you say, where she's being stood over by this huge man, and she looks like she's a small figure, but she's not a defeated figure at all. She's still there being herself. And right till the end, as you say, she was herself. She kept herself intact. She was not colonized. She was not somebody who we need to decolonize. What we need to do is decolonize the narrative about her, which Absolutely. Is what you've done in this book, which is so wonderful. And your own, I said before, your own path to becoming, feeling a need to really write this story comes from actually being on country yourself, walking around in it.
Well, you were saying. The inheritor of the country, actually. I live on Old Station Road, which is the road, the original carriage road to the Oyster Coast Station, where she spent the last years of her life, in fact, the majority years of her life. And that is in Nuinone country. It's immediately across the water from Bruny Island, her country. She regularly went over to Bruny Island. She was always able to commandeer some person to row her over right up until the end of her life. And in fact, when she was moved out of Oyster Cove because the government wouldn't pay the money to support her down there, Don Dandridge, who was the superintendent, said, you know, got them to buy a house in town, and he said, someone has to take her to Bruny Island. She has to go to Bruny Island. And then he died, and there wasn't anybody in Hobart to take her to Bruny Island anymore. But up until that point, she was always visiting her country. And my family, who actually had the largest land grant on Bruny Island, so my family were the people who took Truganini's country, or given Truganini's country, used to see her walking over their land. Of course, it wasn't their land, it was her land, but they wouldn't have seen it that way. And they would give her tea and sugar and so forth, and they marvelled at what a fabulous swimmer she was and how adept she was at finding bushtaka and stuff like that. But that sense that they're talking... many years later, they're talking to a British collector called Ernest Westlake about it, but that they've got this kind of sentimental thing about this old lady or older Aboriginal woman who would wander over their farm and how they'd be so nice to her and that they didn't mind her being there. And, I'm reading this thinking, oh, God, that's my inheritance. My family are very downwardly mobile. We're the most downwardly mobile family in colonial history, I think. So there's none of that inheritance left, but there is a sense that the name Pybus is still to be found on Bruny Island, and then there's Pybus Hill and Pybus Road, and a sense that the land that was once theirs is still marked there. And, of course, you find a lot about the Pybus family on Bruny Island, absolutely nothing about her and Wiredi and the other Nuinone, which is outrageous. And so my sense was that this was in some way my story too, and that my story is, okay, how do I, as the descendants of the settlers who benefited from her dispossession, how do I kind of take responsibility for that? There's no point in feeling guilty about it. How do I take responsibility for that? And I sort of struggle with that. I mean, my first book, Community of Thieves, sort of dealt with this issue, but it's kind of 30 years of thinking about, as I walk on Nuinone land, which I love passionately, what's my responsibility here? And I was waiting, I think, for somebody else to write about Truganini, feeling that perhaps it wasn't my place to do it. But eventually I had to. It was in my heart. I needed to say it. And I needed to say, what happened here happened everywhere. It's just that it was so terrible here because it's an island, and that we are all responsible. Every descendant of settlers, whether they came, in the last wave after the Second World War or whether they came, at the end of the 18th century, walks on stolen land. and has benefited from institutional racism and dreadful violent dispossession, and that we have to acknowledge that, and that we have to ask ourselves, what do we owe? What do we owe? And I think this is an ongoing conversation about what we owe, but we must accept our responsibility. And so to personalise it by writing about this woman who lives in my heart was the way I felt that I had to do it. And I was kind of bracing for a blowback from people who said, you've got no right to tell this story. And I have to confess to you, Jackie, I was a little anxious that you might say that to me.
Well, I mean, for me, as an Aboriginal woman, it's so important to have this story told, and, you know, by somebody who is an expert at interrogating the historical record, but who can bring out the reality of the story. I mean, it's obviously something that has become part of your own story in a way that it was, but it's now really your own story. I love when you say that Tukanini inhabits you now. Well, I'm sure that's what she wanted to do by continuing to walk across your family's country, which was her family's country. She was making the point. I'm sure she was making the point that this is still her country and that she's there. And even if they didn't think deeply about the fact that it was her family's country, that I think in reality you can't avoid that that's what it is. And even I read, in reading the book, I was thinking about your ancestors telling themselves the story that this is now their country, but knowing they would have known that this is the land that, if it was the land of the Nuanani, it still is the land. And by her continuing to go across it, she's reminding people daily that that's, or, you know, as often as she's there, that this is her country. I think of Fanny Balbuk Uriel in the what was Swan River but is now the area of Perth, who, I love the story of this woman who was equally activist as was Tukanini, who just continued to walk across her walking paths that she'd always walked across, and if people had put up a fence, she would just open the gate, walk straight through, walk out the other side, and even cut wire where it was obstructing her capacity to keep walking on her tracks. So here's this Noongar woman who was doing, all over Australia, there were women, as there still are, Aboriginal women who continue to walk in country. My own people, Narugu people, who some of them are from further down the mountains. Those of us who are high country people, we ski, we ride, we walk, we perform ceremony, and we're still there. But we're not noticed, because I think women's history particularly, and it's wonderful to have a woman do women's history particularly is just easy to absorb into these terrible narratives of rape and torture and enslavement. And you know, we make our own choices. Aboriginal women make our own choices. We still do, and we did, and this is what she was doing. And her choice to reject the white man who was so keen to keep her under his thrall, or even get, he never got her in his thrall, as
never
you said.
Got her in his thrall.
I love you talking about how she kept her own religious and cultural practices and pushed back against Christianity. It just never, never attracted her.
Never. There was a debate at the time that she died about her funeral. It was supposed to be a big funeral, but then they got nervous about the fact that, you know, she might be dug up if they knew where she was buried. And so, but in the expectation that there was going to be this big funeral, there was a Christian service when she was buried, but and they dug her up anyway, but 2 years later. But there was this insistence that, yes, she had been baptised and that, yes, she was Christian. She could have a proper Christian burial, but she never was baptised. She, you know, this is a wonderful story about the man who used to go down to Oyster Cove as the visiting minister, and he rode his horse to get there. Of course, that's how you either got there by boat or you rode your horse. He rode his horse over from toward the Huon, and one of the people down there would be like a sentry, and he would lie with his head on the ground, his ear on the ground, and when he heard the horses, obviously he'd give them a signal, and they'd just all disappear, and so there wouldn't be a soul there when he eventually stopped going, because they wouldn't come. And, you know, so the government would always go on about the fact that these poor people were being bereft of Christian teaching, and Dandridge, who was looking after them, would say they hate it. You know, they really, really hate it. They quite like singing the songs, but please don't keep sending them ministers, because they just flee. And so those terrible photographs of them kind of dressed up in European clothes and sort of stood up, you know, taken by Bishop Nixon, he was able to do that because he came by boat and they kind of weren't expecting him. And a number of them aren't in the pictures, so I think a number of them did manage to make their escape. But people look at those. You notice I don't reproduce any of those pictures. Mm. People look at those pictures and say, oh, they look so sad. They're so unhappy. They're so miserable. They were really angry. You have a look at their faces. Mm. They're really cross because, you know, sullen is the word I would use, not doleful, because they're being stopped from going hunting. They're being stopped for going off and into the bush and doing what it is they like to do when they're out in the bush. They, you know, they don't just sit around doing nothing at Oyster Cove waiting to have their photograph taken so it can be displayed in an exhibition of rarities. And so, you know, if I had my way, I would get those photographs destroyed, actually. I find them deeply offensive in a way that I don't feel quite so badly about the Bock drawings which are in my book, I think they're wonderful. They really do capture the essence in some way of these proud, beautiful people. And it is a shame that if you were to Google Tasmanian Aboriginal people or Truganini, the pictures that will be pulled up are these terrible photographs, more often than not. And so rarely do you get the really beautiful images of them. And, you know, they are available. I mean, and it's quite interesting that the image of Truganini that has been constantly used is... we've now, Gay Sculthorpe, who's the curator at the British Museum, and I have clearly established is not her, and that the woman who is her is the woman in the shell necklace, yes, who looks much less pretty, much less pliable, perhaps you might say.
She looks an activist, actually. She looks staring great. Straight
and
out
and
of
she
that
looks
picture
like somebody
with her...
who's pretty worn out, as she would be after that extraordinary experience she had during the year before that painting was done. Now, there's been a bit of pushback against that being her, and I suspect that it's because people have just got so used to the idea of this pretty, pretty round-faced... you know, she's perfect postcard. It's perfect postcard stuff, isn't it, you know?
Yes.
I think actually T-Mag... that's the Tasmanian Museum and Art Gallery have, in fact, at various times made that into a postcard.
The other image I really love in the book is the one that's the naive drawing, if you like.
Oh,
of
yes.
Everybody. I think it reminds me of the lovely works of William Barak and particularly his work in Victoria, which are... And there are drawings from Tiamat Brungle too that have not been published yet that came out of the school there, and of the things we do every day. And I thought, I loved the red beanies. I thought the beanie women they're not beanies, but the red hats, you know.
The red hats.
The hats. And I thought the beanie culture across Australia, the hat-wearing culture of Aboriginal people across Australia is, it's these small things that...
The red hats are really interesting. I was just reading the journal of... it was very short, unfortunately, but it did have some detail in it, of the first person who was in charge of Flinders Island. And, of course, they're under instruction to stamp out their religious practices. And so the men are not allowed to ochre their hair. And this is a real problem for them because the pomaded hair is a huge thing and they feel almost naked without it. So his response to this is to get them red knitted caps. Now, those red knitted caps become the absolutely dominant image in some way of the Aboriginal people of Tasmania. And yet that's where it comes from, that, you know, this guy thought, well, if I get them red knitted caps, maybe that'll kind of... But they did, if they could lay their hands on ochre, you'd be sure that they'd be out there ochreing their hair. But the thing is, there wasn't any ochre on Flinders Island. Mm. And so they had to... But there was a trade in it. Nevertheless, they managed to get sailors who were coming back and forth from Launceston to bring ochre over, and they were never able to stamp out ceremony on Flinders Island. They didn't even try stamping it out at Oyster Cove, I think. And it's interesting that by the time that small group of people, including Truganini, gets to go down to Oyster Cove, they are still having ceremony all the time. Because when Westlake asked people who lived down there and who grew up on the station and who knew them, that's what they talk about. They talk about the ceremonies they had, the dances, and they talk about the men putting the ochre in their hair.
And this is another image in the book, that other drawing of the space, the living space.
Oh, yes.
In the middle, people are corroboree.
Their dogs. I could never get over the number of dogs they had.
Too many dogs.
No. They had at least three or four dogs each.
It's cold.
What you need to understand, these are people who are really hard-pressed for food. They did not have enough food to feed themselves. They fed their dogs, and they had when the so-called big river people were brought in, there were, 30 of them? And they had over 100 dogs. It's an extraordinary thing. And anybody who tried to kill their dogs or to cull their dogs did so at, you know, that would be the end of it. You know, I think one of the people that they actually wrote to the Queen about to complain, one of their major complaints against him was that he'd killed their dogs. He hadn't killed all of them. He'd just culled their dogs, but that was enough. That was enough. That was just, you know. And there she is at the end of her life in Hobart Town, where they like, you know, the major picture of her is wearing bombazine, but she's still got her shell necklaces on.
Yes.
She's sleeping on the floor surrounded by three or four dogs.
All acts of resistance.
I agree.
I think, you know, and the thieving of the dog or just the remove, they just took that dog from the camp in Kulin country. And I thought that was, I think maybe this is a wonderful note to finish on. I could talk to you forever about Truganini. I just think I feel I know this woman much more intimately. I know a lot of Tasmanian, a lot of Palawa women. They're all strong. I see this thread of Truganini running through all these women that I know, the Scalthorpes, absolutely not to be messed with, and have really, and I could, you know, I could list so many, but I won't start now. My own friend Maggie Walter, who was the first Pro Vice Chancellor Indigenous at the University of Tasmania, Kay Price, a leader in Indigenous education. I mean, all of these women, and they still have this same look of Truganini. You know, they are extremely beautiful. They all are proud to wear their marina necklaces. Lola Greeno keeps this practice going. Julie Goff. Are any of these women in any way the victims, the people who have no agency? No, they're not. Tasmanian Palawa women, and this is the wonderful story of this great Palawa woman, Truganini. It was a journey through an apocalypse for her, but her people continue, and you've given them this the voice of this ancestor that is so important. I would love to see this across Australia. We need to see the voices of Aboriginal women.
Well, there you are,
brought
Jackie,
forward.
Off you go.
together, hand in hand, Cassandra, because it is a joint history.
It
you
is
know?
A
this
joint
is
history.
Not
I think truth telling Aboriginal is history. A joint. Is a truth telling has to be, you know, something that we both do, and that hopefully we can do it together. Yeah.
And I see your shell earrings there. So there's, you've been thoroughly colonised, my friend.
Yes, I know.
So I thank you so much. And thank you to the Sydney Writers Festival for giving me the opportunity to learn so much from one of the world's great historians. And we are very fortunate that as Aboriginal people across Australia and also Indigenous people worldwide, that scholars like Cassandra feel that it is part of their duty, which is what I'm hearing, to tell our stories as well, and also to help us feel that our stories are important stories that need to be shared worldwide. So I will say in the language of the Sydney mob, didjerigura, which means thank you in Gadigal, because technically we're meant to be on Gadigal country for this conversation.
Well, thank you, Jackie.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.